Hello, and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with baseball writers and authors, artists and musicians, filmmakers, basically anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Now that we've come to the end of the regular season, we get to see who the geniuses and pretenders are in terms of general managers. On the one end, you have Theo Epstein, who may be on the verge of taking another team that has gone decades in the doldrums, the Chicago Cubs, to the World's Championship, just as he had done with the Boston Red Sox. On the other hand, you have Farhan Zaidi and the Los Angeles Dodgers, who have managed to have the highest payroll with relatively little to show for it. Michael Lewis published Moneyball in 2003. Since then, there have been several books looking into what it takes to put together a team that can compete both on the field and in the ledger. One of the most recent and thorough of this new genre is In Pursuit of Pennants, Baseball Operations from Dead Ball to Moneyball, by Mark Armour and Dan Levitt. I spoke with Armour recently about this joint venture.
Mark Armour, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, can you estimate how many front office employees are on a typical Major League Baseball team these days?
There's some variety, but if you discount the baseball ops people, it's probably anywhere from 10 to 30. And then of course there's the back office people, all the accounting and all those people. That could be another 30 or 50 more people. I know the Red Sox, their media guide has just pages and pages and pages. They probably have 20 vice presidents, most of whom are, you know, lawyers or sales or marketing people, whatnot. But the people that the baseball ops people that are finding players and whatnot is probably 10 to 30, I'm going to guess.
Now, back in the day, and we're talking about when baseball became a professional sport back in the mid-19th century, you had two or three people running the operation?
Well, yeah. I mean, generally you had a manager, field manager, and then you had an owner, and sometimes that would be one or two people, but usually it's, you know, the person that has the money, and sometimes the manager and the owner might even be the same person. And, between the two of them, they'll find the players. Mostly it was the guy in the uniform, you know, the Charlie Comiskey or whoever. That's in the later 19th century that was in charge of finding all the players and signing them and whatnot.
So at what point did this gradually start to evolve into a position where you had the field manager was taking responsibility for the game, played on the field, the owner who may or may not have his finger in the pie, and the general manager or other people who had to start finding the players and expanding the scope of the game as it got more complex?
Well, you know, there's a lot of this has many fathers, but I think the key was probably the Yankees, as they so often are. And I think it started because Jake Rupert, he had a partner for a few years, but basically Jake Rupert had the money. He bought the team in 1915. And at that point, you started to have actual moneyed capitalists that were interested in baseball teams as opposed to former players or whatnot. And so you had a guy that bought a team, and he didn't really consider himself capable of finding players and scouting and whatnot. So although Rupert never stayed away from the team, he was a very active CEO. He hired Ed Barrow in 1920. To essentially be what we would now call a general manager. He had a different name. I think he was called the business manager, but basically he was the general manager. And there were a couple other peers that he had. I mean, Ricky's was complicated because he was the manager occasionally as well. But Ricky, basically by around 1920, was a general manager too. And so there were other people around that same time. But Barrow was probably the most famous and best, and, you know, once the Yankees started to win, then teams started to gradually go to that model. It didn't. The model didn't really disappear, though, until I would say until Charles Finley and Calvin Griffith sold their teams in the 80s. They were essentially general managers still until then. So it was a long process that it got to everybody using the same model, which everyone uses today.
The subtitle of In Pursuit of Pennants is Baseball Operations from Deadball to Moneyball. Now, one of the problems I have with the Moneyball concept is that people, for perhaps younger fans, younger than middle age, think that Moneyball is a totally new concept, but haven't front offices been looking at various statistics for years when deciding how to develop their teams?
Yeah, I think that most you know, smart teams, smart GMs have always used whatever tools were available to them. And most of them, when that happens, until they're successful, people tend to look askance at that. Certainly the Dodgers were using rudimentary statistical analysis and pretty sophisticated scouting in the 50s, sophisticated in the sense that they were mapping sort of pitch location and figuring out sort of where batters should be swinging and where pitchers should be pitching based on data as opposed to just pure scouting. It was a gradual kind of process. I think Moneyball, what people call Moneyball, it certainly accelerated the process, probably in the 90s and in the early aughts. It was certainly got a little faster. And I think that what people see from the outside is they see that there are what you would call non-baseball people that are starting to infiltrate front offices, people that didn't grow up necessarily as players. They may have played as kids, but they didn't really come out of the traditional places that GMs come out of. And that started happening, I think, more in the 90s than it had happened before. I mean, this Ricky is much of a genius as he was. He was an old catcher. And that's what most of the GMs still were until pretty recently.
What would you say was the biggest innovation or issue prior to expansion?
Well, probably speaking specifically about baseball operations, I mean, what we call baseball operations today and what Dan and I talk about it in the book is largely the process of finding players and evaluating the players and instructing the players and the stuff that happens really it involves everything, including coaching and whatnot. It would either be, I guess, depending on how you wanted to define your question, it would either be the evolution of the farm system or the development of the farm system, which largely happened in the 30s, a little bit before that as well, but it was kind of illegal in the 20s, but Ricky still had one. And then, the biggest innovation, innovation is an odd word to use in this case, but the biggest change in the game was certainly integration, which happened in the 40s and 50s, and that is an innovation in a sense that once Ricky signed Jackie Robinson in 1945, besides the ethical and moral consequences that obviously entailed, from the point of view of a team that's building, which is something we're interested in, it really changed the game considerably because this was a vast pool of talent that was suddenly available. It had been available before, but it was practically available now to people that both had the moral courage to get there fast and also the skill to scout in new places and whatnot. And that was certainly a vast sea change. And once that started happening, then it really accelerated going into Latin America as well, because a lot of the Latin American players were also prohibited from playing because of their skin color. And then you have, I think that has sort of led to what we sort of have today, which is teams that are scouting, you know, almost literally all over the world.
Now, you mentioned before that the farm system at one point was illegal. Why was it illegal?
Well, there were various baseball rules in place to keep the minor leagues free. Judge Landis, who was the commissioner of baseball starting in 1921, he was pretty adamant about the fact that all these minor leagues needed to be independent and free, and he didn't like the fact that that teams were controlling players in the minor leagues. So they had different rules that you had, you know, you sort of had a limit to how many players you were allowed to sort of have control of beyond the people that were on your roster. And it was usually 40 players, maybe total, sort of like what they have today. So today we have 40-man rosters, but then they also have another few hundred players that are essentially owned by the Los Angeles Dodgers. And that didn't used to be legal. So what teams would then do is a way to get around it is that Ricky would buy minor league teams, and he'd be the operator of the minor league team and the major league team, and therefore he would have transactions between these two teams, which he was largely, you know, he was basically both halves of that transaction. And that went on for several years, and Landis was always sort of getting involved and declaring people that, you know, free and whatnot. And this went on for quite some time until sometime in the early 30s that the major leagues essentially got together, largely because the minor leagues were kind of going broke as well. So they kind of wanted help. And they sort of changed the rules and said, okay, you can control a certain number of players, you know, more players in the minor leagues than you could before. So the major leagues were sort of going in that direction, but it was all a little bit under the table until they codified it in the 30s.
You mentioned the innovations prior to expansion. What about since expansion?
Certainly you had the amateur draft that came in the 60s, and that largely was to save money from the point of view of the owners. And that period that we discuss a bit in the book from 1965 to 1976 is kind of the period of the really the pure GM, probably the time when money meant the least in baseball because players had the least rights that they'd ever had. There'd always been a reserve clause, but until 1965, at least the player had one decision he could make, which is where to sign, what his first team could be, and then he had no rights basically after that. Once the draft came in, then the player had zero control over his career. And at that point, the signing of players became, you know, democratic from the point of view of a team. The Yankees no longer had any advantages in terms of finding players, and the Cardinals and all these teams. It was kind of a tie. And they had no advantages in terms of free agency because that didn't exist yet. So it was kind of like, you know, like a rotisserie league in the sense that everybody is sort of created equal. They all have the same amount of money, basically, et cetera. So then free agency changed everything again. Certainly pretty dramatically. And I believe that free agency kind of led to the need for analytics, which came along later, because up until free agency, when you had control over an entire player's career, you know, and everybody had one-year contracts, it wasn't incredibly crucial that you knew how these players were going to age or develop or when that player was going to kind of run out of gas, because, you know, you only had it for 1 year, and then the guy hits 230, and you say, okay, it's time. We need another third baseman now. But today, you can't really do that because you need to sort of see into the future. You need to be able to say, hey, I got a 31-year-old free agent third baseman, or maybe he's my third baseman, it doesn't really matter, and I want to give him a 5-year contract, or he wants one. What does that look like? What does his future look like? And Branch Rickey didn't really have to know that. And there was some advantages to knowing that, but it wasn't a roster killer if you got it wrong. Whereas today, you have to know that, and GMs lose their jobs because they got that wrong. And that's, I think, one of the largest things that analytics has done in the past 15 years is essentially predict the future and try and map what a person's career is most likely to be. They never will get it completely right, but they're getting probably closer than they used to, and that's all because of free agency, I believe.
Now, it's funny that you mentioned predicting the future, because right now we have a situation with Matt Harvey of the New York Mets where they are trying to hold his innings down based on prolonging his career. And
right.
My thought is he has the same agent as Steven Strasburg of the Nationals, Scott Boras, and the Nationals clamped down on Strasburg's innings when he had to deal with a similar injury. But since then, he's had other injuries. So even though you protect yourself perhaps against something right now, there's no guarantee, there's no predicting. You know, he could step on a rake in his backyard and get an injury there that'll be the end of his career.
Yeah, I mean that's a tough one. I mean it's if Boras is right, and you know I see no advantage to Boras making this pronouncement or suggestion, whatever you want to put it, unless he believed he was right, and he's just, you know, he's not a dumb guy. But if he's right, he's barely right. I mean maybe Harvey is slightly less likely to get injured if he falls this pattern. But it's not like, and I think that's what people maybe get jump on Boras about. It's not like there's no guarantees either way. He could be Randy Johnson. I mean, Randy Johnson could throw, over 300 innings a year and never seem to get hurt. And some guys, you know, some guys can't do it. It's something we don't know that much about, and I'm sure it's frustrating for fans. I'm sure it's frustrating for the pitchers, and I know it's frustrating for the teams because, anticipating a potential follow-up question, there is probably no bigger innovation that any team could make, in the next 30 or 40 years than a way to come up with something that would prevent or reduce pitcher injuries. And I don't, know what that could be. I mean, I've almost imagined if the economics of the situation change, as well as the intrusiveness of this change, if you could imagine sort of taking an MRI of someone's elbow and shoulder in between every pitch. If you just sort of, I mean, that's like way beyond my science fiction knowledge, but if you could do that and you could sort of say, hey, there's a little bit of, there's 5% additional swelling here. He shouldn't throw any more pitches today. But until then, I don't know what to do, and I think Boras is trying to protect this guy. But the counter argument is that if Matt Harvey never pitches again, he'll never get hurt. So, at some point, it's in his interest to pitch, and I don't know when that's going to be.
I think one of the problems fans of a certain age have is that they look back to people like a Bob Feller or Christy Mathewson, guys who regularly threw 250, 300 innings a year for many years. I mean, even Sandy Koufax, who had a brief but brilliant window, was pitching over 300 innings a year for 5-6 years.
Right.
And today, with all the technology we have and all the training techniques we have, pitchers seem to get hurt at a much more alarming rate. I don't know if that's a product of better ways to diagnose injuries or what, but it just seems that today's players are not as tough as yesterday's.
Yeah, I have a couple of responses to that. One is, and I, again, I think this is an area that we just don't really know that much about. But Koufax, I think you could just as easily use as an argument on the other side, since he in fact broke down at 30. And maybe you could say to Matt Harvey, do you want Sandy Koufax's career? And I don't know how old Harvey is. He's probably 25 or something. You get 5 more great years, and then you're going to be sitting home with your kids. Maybe he doesn't take that. I don't know. Seems like most of us would, but we're not even close to either of them. And the other thing is that I think that what's likely that actually was happening in the 60s, when there were so many workhorses, is that you had 100 pitchers, and all of them were pitched with comparatively low regard for their future. They just, people were 19 years old and they were throwing 225 innings. And I think most of them broke down, and the ones that didn't break down ended up pitching forever. So it's like you have this obstacle course, and the guys that get through the obstacle course, Steve Carlton and Tom Seaver and on, pitch forever, whereas the guys like Gary Nolan and Wayne Simpson and all these guys that got hurt at 21 or 22, we just sort of forget about. So I think there were injuries, but I think they happened even younger because these guys were, Jim Bowden talks about, even in his book, and he was completely oblivious to this when he's writing, but he just, all of a sudden, he pitched a lot of innings for the Yankees in 63 and 64, and as far as I know, he has never complained about that. He's never said, they threw me too much, whatever. He came in the next year, he had a sore arm. They had him pitch through it, and he never came back. And I think this was probably a common story.
Now, is that a function of they didn't have the technology to diagnose injuries in those days? Or, you're our employee, you'll do what we tell you, and you'll throw until your arm falls off?
I expect that they cared about him. I think they wanted Jim Bowden to have a good career because it's in their interest for that to happen. But I think... Yeah, I think there was a tradition of that if your arm is sore, I think that Bowden might have, I don't even remember now, but he talked about it a little bit in Ball 4, where I think that there was an expectation he was just going to pitch through it. And I think Bowden also talked about that there was, the mentality of the pitchers themselves. They're incredibly competitive people by nature, professional athletes, and they want to pitch well, and they also want to keep their jobs. And he talks about, you would go into the trainer's room, and if somebody found you in the trainer's room, then you might not start the next game. And you wanted to start the next game. So these, the pitchers didn't know what was going on. I think Bowden later, many years later, said that he almost undoubtedly had torn his rotator cuff, which is something, words that we didn't know then. And he just didn't know it and just pitched through it.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the process of writing this book. This book was your second, I believe, written with Daniel Levitt.
Yes.
How is the process? How do you divide the labor in a project like this? Who does what?
Well, when we wrote our first book, which was in 2003, it came out, so we wrote it over the previous few years, we were both relatively novice writers. We'd written, journal articles and whatnot, but we kind of, we saw each other at a Sabre convention. We'd known each other for a few years, and I think we just sort of said, hey, let's write a book. We have these ideas. We'd been talking about things, and a lot of it was similar to what we talk about in this book. It was an exploration of different teams and how they got to the point that they became good, sort of the building of a team, that process. The ideas weren't as cohesive as we made them in this book. But nonetheless, it was sort of in the same vein. And what we did in that case is we kind of divided up, you know, why don't you write about this, I'll write about that, and then we kind of stitched them together and maybe and edited each other quite a bit, and then tried to, you know, sew them together and try and create a common thread between them. In this book, since we've been working together for many years, we've done a lot of, we've certainly done a lot, our share of writing separately, but we've also come back to each other on occasion and with articles or whatnot. But this book, since we knew each other much more, there was a lot more, I think that, you know, so for example, Dan would start off and say, I got this idea, I'm going to talk about Jacob Rupert and how he sort of put the Yankees front office together, and he read a chapter about it. And I think that after 12 years, that I'd be much more likely to read that and say, I have another idea. Why don't we add this section here and talk about the farm system and maybe break this into two chapters. And I think there's a lot more sort of evolution that we're essentially stepping on each other's toes, I think, a lot more. So we did design the book in the sense of, it, you know, it's a chronological story, and we did kind of sit down at one point and say, here we're going to talk about a little bit in this period and how its instruction evolved and how integration and free agency and whatnot. Although as we moved along and ideas interest us, then we certainly moved stuff around and added stuff and had further ideas. And there's probably very little in this book that doesn't have both of our fingerprints on it. Although in all cases, there was one person that sort of started the chapter.
Now, this is, you've got several books with the University of Nebraska Press. Are they your go-to publisher at this point, or do you try to find someone else who might take on the project?
Well, so both Dan and I wrote up a book separately for the University of Nebraska Press. So they both, you know, so they knew us, and the reason for the University of Nebraska Press is that they have a baseball editor and have a line of baseball books that come out every year. I don't know if it's six or eight or something like that. So they have a person that's sort of dedicated to finding, and, you know, he's in charge of coming out with this baseball line every year. So we both, you know, got on that train a few years ago. He did a book on Ed Barrow, and I did a book on Joe Cronin. We both went there. And because of that, they knew us. And we were approached several years ago by Rob Taylor, who is the editor there, and told us that they had just bought, that Nebraska had just bought the catalog of Potomac. And Potomac is the people that wrote our first book, that published our first book. They were called Brassies then, and then became Potomac. And Nebraska bought their line. I'm not sure exactly what that means in terms of the business world, but they now had our book in their catalog, or, you know, the old, and they had all the old copies in the warehouse. So he came to us and said, well, have you ever thought about putting this book out again and maybe, you know, adding a couple of chapters and an intro or something like that? Because the book had, we had a little bit of success and had got some good reviews, and he just asked us about this. And we started ruminating on this, and we went from taking the old book and adding a couple of chapters to, let's add a few more chapters and take a few chapters out. And then in our head, we just said, you know what, let's just write a new book. And we went back to them and said, what do you think about this idea? And they said yes. So we never tried to find a commercial publisher. We just went directly to them. And they were generous because they gave us a contract before we'd really even started on the book. And we had a few delays along the way because of personal things intervening with having a kids and whatnot, but eventually we put the book out. And we're happy with the job they do.
I'm just curious, having never collaborated with another writer, if it's easier for the publisher to deal with one writer rather than two when it comes to editing or suggestions or things along that nature. Now, since you've been in both situations, do you have any thoughts on that?
In our particular case, we have such a great, an easy relationship with the people there. They know us. That it's probably a little bit harder for them because, they do have to, they may have twice as many people bothering them. Not that we really do that very much. But in terms of the actual process for them, we handed in a manuscript, and then some amount of time goes by where they're dealing with it, cover and title and stuff like that. That's something that they own. And then they come back to us with so they hire a copy editor. We gave them a pretty tight manuscript. We'd had a number of people read it, so it wasn't like they were getting, really raw material. But they did have a copy editor, and then they send it to us. But that's all electronic now, so they don't have to worry about sending two copies. And then another couple months go by, and then they sent us. We marked it up with changes or agreements or whatever. And then they sent us what is essentially page proofs, and the process sort of continued. But I don't think mechanically it's that much harder for them. I think that if the authors get along and are speaking as one voice, I would imagine that if you asked Nebraska, they would say that it was pretty easy.
And you certainly hope that's the case in working with multiple authors. Well, we've been talking with Mark Armour, who with Daniel Levitt has recently published In Pursuit of Penance, Baseball Operations from Deadball to Moneyball. Mark, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
I appreciate you having me on. It was a great conversation.
And that was our bookshelf conversation with Mark Armour. Tune in again next time. We'll have another interesting guest in the world of baseball, literature, pop culture, etc. Remember, for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews, visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com. And if you have any questions or comments, please don't hesitate to send me an email at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. See you later. Had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a